Okay, let's get started. So today is about parallel and distributed languages. So why are we looking into these languages? Basically because of the current multi-core revolution, right? Everybody needs to program his programs in parallel and potentially distributed as well, even on a single chip. There's a lot of research currently going on chips that have multiple cores and communicate via message passing. So there is a small network called network on a chip processors. There's effectively a number of cores and is communicate with message passing. So even on these kinds of chips, you're going to need languages which are effectively distributed, but distributed on a single chip. So another way to look at this is you should program your programs as natural and as close as to the domain in which you are programming in. If you're programming something related to physics, it makes sense to have a programming language which incorporates some of the same concepts that you have in your physics problem, right? Program in a language that is close as to your problem domain. So if your program, the problem that you're trying to solve is inherently parallel, it makes sense to have a parallel language as well. So parallel languages not only make things faster, they can also make it easier to understand because they are closer to what you're trying to solve. Right? Of course, some problems are inherently too big to solve in a single machine with a single core or use too much memory and so forth. So here's a problem with inherent parallelism, right? For example, you're trying to simulate some real situation, right? You have cars that are driving over roads, and you have stoplights, and you want to know how many cars could there be on my roads before a traffic jam occurs. It's very hard to analytically solve such a problem using queuing theory, for example. It's easier to simulate such a situation and then see if a traffic jam occurs. So how do you program a system such as this? Well, you have cars that are driving independently of each other, so the cars are driving independent and therefore should be simulated in parallel. You have, it fits nicely to a discrete event simulation. And in such a discrete event simulation, you have clocks which are naturally independent, right? Every car is independent, every stoplight is independent. There are random events that you need to generate, so for all possible permutations of something, do something, and all of these permutations are inherently parallel to each other, with no dependencies between each other, and so forth. So there are a number of problems that are inherently parallel, where it makes programming easier if you were to use a parallel programming language. So in such programming languages, you usually have a number of virtual CPUs that you can create on demand, or like threads, right? And you have some sort of communication substrate. Right? These processors need to communicate in some way. So either you have shared memory between the cores, or you have distributed memory. And distributed memory does not mean a cluster. It can also mean a network on a chip, right? So you have different paradigms for shared memory programming and distributed memory programming. Even though there's currently another trend going on, where distributed memory programming is used to program shared memory machines. Because, for example, Google Go is some language like this, where you have processors that communicate via message passing, even though the machine itself is using shared memory. Why are we doing this? Because distributed memory programming via message passing makes a number of problems disappear that you normally have with shared memory programming. For example, if you communicate via message passing, you do not require locks. Locks are only needed for shared memory programming. We'll look at those in a bit. So what kind of problems can there be when you're programming something, some parallel program? Well, you have deadlocks, right? So you're symmetrically waiting for each other. We have live locks, where you are symmetrically backing off from some resource and then trying again. Everybody knows these two problems. Another problem is load balancing. So every processor should perform the same amount of work. From a programming language standpoint, The first two have programming languages solutions. So if you have a programming language which is very, which structures parallelism in a nice way, then you can avoid both deadlocks and live locks via the programming language. Avoiding load imbalances, that is something that's very hard to trigger from a programming language. How do you, from a programming language's standpoint, guarantee that there is a good load balance? That is very hard to do. That is research. Nobody is really focusing on that. Data races. A data race is where two processors are concurrently trying to access the same resource, and one of them is writing. Right? So you're never sure if your reading processor will see the old or the new value or a mixture, right? Or something corrupted. Again, a data race is very hard to find, especially compared to live locks and deadlocks. Deadlocks and live locks are easy. Load balancing is a little harder. It's manageable. So easy, manageable, really hard. Deadlocks, however, can again be avoided via programming languages. So with a good programming language, you can avoid race conditions via built-in semantics. So difficult, but solvable by programming language. Difficult, no, but manageable, but not solvable by a programming language, and solvable and solvable. Right? So let's look at some concepts that we have for parallel programming in a programming language. The first is coroutines. So coroutines are not really parallel. It's just a way of writing a program which is with mutually exclusive parallel executions. So one processor can run, and when it's finished, something else can run, and when that's finished, something else can run again. For example, you have some sort of a resume statement where you resume the other mutually exclusively. So either this guy runs or that guy runs, but they're not really running in parallel. They are handing off execution. So those are coroutines. It's a little bit like the yield statement that we saw in last lecture, the lecture before that, right? With Python and Icon. It's like a yield statement, but then across processors. So the coroutines are not really parallel. It's just a way of simulating parallelism. So it can be grafted upon a normal functional or imperative language without too much heartache. For example, by using set jump, long jump in C, for example, you can program coroutines. So this is like pseudo-parallelism. So we're not really there yet. What other languages do is add a number of statements for instantiating virtual processors. So parallel begin, and then a number of statements, and all these statements will be run on a different virtual processor. So you in one step you go and let something run on three processors, right? Or parallel 4 is also very popular in many languages, where it assign each iteration a different processor, conceptually. And every processor will receive a different loop variable value, right? These are all fairly simple to create in a language, and therefore almost most of them have some form of parallel 4. With parallel 4, you have the problem of granularity. Granularity is the problem of how much work should each processor do. How fine should I cut up my domain into pieces, and how big should these pieces be? So how fine should I assign work to processors? If I let every processor process a single loop iteration, there's a lot of overhead for administration. Right? I have to keep track of which loop iteration has finished, which is still to do, and so forth. And that costs a lot of administrative overhead. So how do I add in a programming language some fashion of granularity for how fine should I distribute the work? Mostly this is left to the runtime system, where the runtime system decides how fine granular the work packages should be, how small should the work packages be. There's not much going on in automatically figuring out how big a work package should be. It's not in the compiler side or the language side. what's mostly done is letting the programmer decide how big something should be via some sort of annotation. Parallel for. These parallel fors can of course also be nested, right? So with normal for statements, so if you have a matrix multiply, then you have parallel for, and then some sequential for statement in the middle. And then you as the programmer have to decide which of these I should do in parallel. Should I do the inner one as well, or only the outer ones? So again, this is a way of specifying granularity. You as a programmer should fine tune the granularity to fit your algorithm. You as a programmer have some idea of what a good granularity of your problem is, what should be done in sequential and what should be done in parallel. So this is mostly left to the programmer. How to, at a programming language level, specify granularity and machine efficiency and load balance in one go via some sort of constraint system, that is future work. Nobody has made some real progress here. This is where you do research. In a programming language, add support for granularity, locality, for specifying what should be synchronized and what should not be synchronized, what can be done sequentially in parallel, automatically finding granularity. That is research, so master thesis work, PhD thesis. So in one way, these solve the easy problem, right? Starting something in parallel that is easy. How to deal with deadlock and live lock, that is fairly easy to do, right? Because if you have a parallel for loop, it's difficult to create some deadlock or a live lock because they are the structure doesn't allow it of these constructs. It does not help structure your parallelism, right? It does not say how large your granularity should be. That is still left to the programmer. Easy safe access to data shared. So how do I avoid data races? That is something outside of these statements mostly. Right? So parallel for solves the easy problem. It does not absolve you from race conditions. So processes is a very common paradigm for distributed programming. Right, where every iteration of something or every parallel task is run in a different process, or at least conceptually in a different process. It's not specified if it's actually in the same process. So you have a sort of fork join, right? Like fork and run process type in a new process, be it in the same physical Unix process or in a different Unix process. It's not specified. You fork it, and then for every function that is possibly forked, you need to have some sort of annotation that states that this thing can run in parallel. That's some kind of process or type annotation. How do we use these things? Well, here's a trivial example. If you write a compiler, right, you have some sort of main, you parse your input files, and then you fork compute tasks for every source file that you have, and then wait for all of these compile tasks to finish, and then you link everything in. So you fork compute tasks, compile tasks, compile them, store the object file, and then exit your parent task. So this is a simple way for distributed programming. Right? There's some problems here. Right, how do I specify that something is shared between processes? And how do I specify that something is private to the parent or to the child? So I need some extra annotations here to guide locality again. I cannot assume that everything is private, and I also cannot assume that everything is shared, at least from a performance standpoint. So multiprocessor is allocate every shared variable then in shared memory, and if I have a distributed memory machine, I usually send messages for shared memory access. Right, but what kind of language level guarantees I have, it varies wildly. What you have in terms of consistency, atomicity. One problem that is very common for such fork join style programs is producer consumer. So if you have a producer consumer problem, it's easy to map them to a fork join model. for example, I have some sort of pipelining problem, right? I want to wash clothes, right? And I first have to a basket of dirty clothes, and I put them in a washing machine. And from the washing machine, they go in a drying machine. Then it's an ironing machine, then a folding machine, and then I'm finished. Right? So I have a natural pipeline of things, and every pipeline stage can run in parallel. This is natural parallelism. So this should be effectively naturally model to, or at least match to some other programming model, a parallel programming model with pipelines. So let's try this with a shared memory model. Right? I have a process washer, and I have a shared buffer between the washer and the dryer. So the washer gets some clean pants, right? Waits until I can wash, dry them. If I can dry them, then I put them in the buffer so that the dryer can, of course, waits until he sees some clean clothes, gets them from the buffer, dries them, and then you're done. And then try for the next thing to dry, right? So the synchronization here, this guy needs to wait for the dryer to have a slot available so he can dry something. And this guy needs to wait for the washer to give him some stuff to dry, right? Wait for stuff to dry, wait for the dryer to finish. So there's synchronization here. If I program it in such a way, that's of course full of race conditions, right? There's a race in this count plus plus waiting for this count, right? And also there's busy waiting, right? There's busy waiting because you're in a while loop spinning, waiting for the other guy to finish, right? Or to give a free slot. That's not very nice. So how do we get around this? How do we get around these two problems? Well, the first thing is, what are the possible conditions for a race, right? What's for the data race? So if I have count plus plus, translates to a memory load, increment on some local processor local variable, and then store it back again. The message here is that no programming level statement is ever truly atomic, right? It cannot be guaranteed. So if start with memory count is 5, both of them try to do an increment, and their result is 6 instead of 7, right? That's clear, because both of them load them, increment at the same time. What other processors are doing, if you have a RISC processor cannot load a large constant or store a large variable in memory atomically. So if I have if I want to perform a large assignment, A, B, B, C, C, D, 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 right? And it translates internally to 4 individual stores. And all of these between all of these individual stores, some other thread can come along or another processor can come along and mess up your single write, right? So this guy writes something, this guy tries to write a different address, and what ends up in memory is some sort of mixture, right? So even a single variable assignment cannot be assumed to be data race free. So what we need is some form of mutual exclusion. Mutual exclusion means enforcing sequential execution at least for a given object data access. Right? So mutual exclusion forces something to be run sequentially. So it excludes everybody else from accessing some data item at the same time. So it's a critical section. You also have condition synchronizations where you wait for some condition to become true. Wait for the buffer to be free, or wait for the buffer to be empty. So a popular way of implementing critical sections or mutual exclusion is via locks. You have some lock. You lock it, do your sequential stuff, in respect to that to those data accesses, and then unlock. So everything here is sequential in respect to lock to count. Another popular mutual exclusion implementation is semaphores, although semaphores are really never implemented in a language. Everybody uses locks for mutual exclusion. You never see semaphores in a language. So have a P statement which increments the semaphore, which is similar to an unlock, and you have a V statement for which decrements it, and you can only allow it to be go into an atomic section if the semaphore is less than one, less than zero. Right, so programming the same thing with semaphores, right? Wait for the dryer, do your stuff and increment it. And the other way is symmetric, right? What is the what are the advantages of semaphores over locks? Locks are only allow one entity into a critical section. A semaphore can allow a number of them into a critical section because there is a counter going on. So with semaphores, I can allow up to a given number of workers into a critical section. So what are the problems with locks or semaphores? The first thing is locking granularity. I have to, in my programming language, manually insert these lock and unlock statements, and I can make it make these critical sections too small or either too big. If I make them too small, I've forgotten to lock something, right? Protect something with a lock, and my program will be incorrect. If I make my critical sections too large, then I make my program run in sequential mode too long, and it be not as performant as it could be. So associated with locking and unlock is a locking strategy. Locking strategy means where do I insert my lock? I need to have some sort of strategy to decide where a lock and an unlock should be inserted in my code. There are a number of other things for locking strategy is, for example, copy on write. Whenever I want to write something, I first create a copy of it, modify it locally, right? And then store the, try and keep working on the copy and potentially store that copy back, right? So privatization is another word. Another is update others. Is the idea here is instead of modifying my own variable, everybody has a local copy of a variable. So the resource is replicated. And whenever I want to update something, I modify all the replicas. And whenever I want to read something, I can access my local replica. Optimistic versus pessimistic locking. That means optimistic locking is I assume that most of the time nobody will be interested in the same critical section at the same time. Then I can perform some optimizations. For example, transactional memory. In other ways, pessimistic, that is the old style lock and unlock or synchronized blocks as you know it in Java. There's a number more of them. Let's see what you can see in the parallel algorithms lecture. So, monitors. If you write your lock and unlock lock statements in your code, it's very easy to sometimes forget your lock and unlock statement. So it's perhaps better to create some sort of language level encapsulation of these lock and unlock statements. So the idea here is you have a sort of abstract data type, right? And whenever you try and access your abstract data type, you need to access that them via functions, right? Because an abstract data type, you could not look into the implementation of an abstract data type. You could only access an abstract data type via the methods defined on that ADT, right? And these, if you mark a ADT with a sort of modifier for like monitor, then all of these entry and exits of these ADT accessing functions will be automatically locked and unlocked. So with an ADT, with a monitor, the lock and unlock statements are automatically inserted. You don't have to write them manually. So it's a sort of language level way of inserting locks and unlocks in your code. You don't have to write synchronized. You say synchronized class, in effect, if you think about it in Java terms. You mark the class synchronized, and you don't mark the methods or the blocks in your code as synchronized. You mark the whole class synchronized. That is the idea. This is concurrent Pascal, effectively, right? Concurrent Pascal, you have your monitor buffer, and you mark your, it's a monitor, therefore all the operations inside of your monitor are automatically synchronized. So an operation runs atomically. This is atomic operation, this is an atomic operation. Whenever you do a wait statement, it unlocks the lock associated with the monitor atomically, performs the waiting operation, it waits until not full, it's true. And then once not full is true, it automatically reacquires the lock and continues execution. So there's an implicit lock here, there's an implicit unlock here, and there's an implicit lock here, and there's an implicit unlock there. Right? So all the locks and unlocks are implicit. Right. So this is, again, we've now avoided the busy waiting problem as well. So there are now no longer any possibilities of data races because the lock and unlock is implicit. And there is no busy waiting anymore because the wait statement internally schedules away the thread. So there's no more busy waiting anymore as well. So it's both more efficient and to be guaranteed to be correct. At least correct in terms of parallelism. Okay, those were all shared memory. A large class of problems can only be solved when using multiple machines, right? Or at least when you're not looking at these NOC chips. If you need multiple machines, then it makes sense. You need to send messages between these machines for communication, and that can be mapped to language level entities. So inside of your language, you have a send routine and a receive statement. No, not a routine. You have a send statement and a receive statement to send and receive messages. And these are implemented in the language. This is not library calls. This is not a function to some library to do something. It's a send and receive are implemented in your language itself. Right? Because there is no shared resource between them, there are no race conditions. What can, however, happen is live locks and deadlocks. Deadlocks and live locks are the enemies of message passing, right? Because these systems are all distributed, finding a deadlock or a potential live lock is a little harder than you would have in a shared memory language. However, again, they can be found at compile time. So a race condition is a little harder to find at compile time, but a deadlock, most languages have syntax for detecting deadlocks in message passing programs. Here's an example. Right? You have a compiler which generates some assembler, and like a coroutine, it sends a message to the assembler who receives that message with a single line of assembler code, assembles it, and then tries to get the next line of assembler for assembling. So OCaml is a language which has the send and receive statement as primitives in its language. Right? So there are channels, communication channels for communicating between abstract processes. And for example here, these channels are typed. So you say, I want a channel where over the channel I can send and receive integers. And when I write a question mark, it means I can read from this channel. And when I write an exclamation mark, it means I can send data over this channel. Right? So a readable channel, writable channel. I have no read-write channels. You can't mark a channel as both question mark and exclamation mark. You need to choose either one or the other. If you need a bidirectional channel, you should have a structure with both channel types. Right? So you need to allocate two channel types if you want to, two channels if you want a bidirectional channel. Here's an example. Code starts in main with a channel for the keyboard and a channel for the screen and a channel for the standard error. So standard error, standard output, and standard input. So the keyboard is also communicated via channel, right? So whenever I want to read something from the keyboard, screen, with an exclamation mark was a write message. So I here send as a message to the screen. So it writes an A. 10 is a new line character in ASCII. So it's a goes to the next line in the code. And here I read something from a channel. So in ?V reads a value from the input channel and writes it to the V variable. Right? Every code block I should mark with either parallel or sequential. So this is foo and bar are executed in parallel. And screen reads, writes, and input reads are then sequentially executed one after the other. So now I have to explicitly think about do I really need to execute this in parallel or sequential? You're forced to think about parallelism. Right? There's something more complex. Here I have a foo and a bar that I execute in parallel. So this guy and this guy are running in parallel. This guy tries to write something to the screen in parallel to this guy writing something to the screen. So now we have a race condition, right? Both are trying to write stuff on a channel, and it's undefined yet if first the B or the A will be a character will be written to the screen. So this is a race condition. What Occam does is disallow concurrent access to channels. What it does is it makes a communication graph internally. Right? There's a graph, a conservative graph that starts in main. So main creates a graph that says parallel, and then bar, and foo. And it'll say, oh, there's another screen object somewhere here. Boo is executing, bar is sending something concurrently with foo executing something on the same channel. And therefore, there is a race condition. So the Occam compiler takes this program, creates a graph where some edges are parallel, but simultaneous sense. Some will be input for simultaneous input. And therefore, simultaneous input is forbidden, so it can give an error. Right. There are no locks. Huh? Yes.
So how is it?
It makes a conservative approximation via this graph. This graph encompasses all possible versions, right?
Okay.
So conservative solution for error checking. Here's another little bit of program. You can make more complex message types. For example, here as a protocol. Right? And the protocol is either message 0 and message 1, and they are both messages are structured by byte int. Right? So you don't have to write a separate channel for byte, a separate channel type for int. I can aggregate messages into more complex structured message types. Of course, you cannot send pointers over the network. Right? So you cannot write a more complex data type. You cannot create a structure with a pointer to some other structure or message type and then pack it in. No, it doesn't work. So you cannot create more complex message types with pointers and references and whatnot over network cables. Right? So what are the options here in distributed programming? For something with sends and receives messages. What are the things that I need to think about? Well, first I need to think about addressing. How do I know what my receiver is called? My receiver should have a name somehow, and I should be able to find that name or construct that name. This is CSP, Communicating Sequential Processes. This is the Occam model, right? In Occam, you had sequential pieces of code that communicate by sending messages, right? Communicating, sequential process. So Occam deviates a little bit because there's these parse statements in your code. But in pure communicating sequential processes model, you have sequential programs that communicate via message passing. Right. Another way of looking at communication is to look at it in a more object-oriented way. where you have objects, and every object has a mailbox, and whenever you send a message, it is placed in the receiver's mailbox, and whenever the receiver has some time, it can look into this local mailbox, see that there is a letter and or some message, unpack the message and execute the contained commands. So there are some object-oriented ways of looking at message passing. It's more, this is the sort of agent style. We'll look at agents in a later lecture. Another versions of send receive is, how do I manage synchronous and asynchronous message passing? In most languages that contain send receive have only the synchronous versions of message passing, where the semantics of a send is wait until the receiver has accepted my send. Right? If you look at, for example, cluster computing, when you have something like MPI, there are also versions of asynchronous sends, where an asynchronous send just copies whatever you want to send in a local buffer for later sending. Right? Most languages don't have support for such more advanced runtime concepts. So asynchronous sends, you mostly don't see them really. But there are languages as R and Hermes that have support for asynchronous send statements and asynchronous receive statements. But most common, it's everything is synchronous. The same holds for the receiver side. So you have asynchronous and synchronous send. You also have synchronous and asynchronous receive statements. Explicit receipt, explicit blocking synchronous receipt is most common, where you see it in Occam, CSP, and also in Go, in Google Go. Google Go is the is a language that you can look at for the exercises, for one of the exercise problems. An alternative for explicit receipt is sort of active message idea, where you send a message to some receiver and automatically in the receiver a message is received and a function is called to process the message in a new thread. Well, that happens. Right? So in Occam, a message is either for read-only or for write-only. Right? Full duplex channels also exist as a language-level concept. Example, you see full duplex channels in, I think, does Google Go do full duplex channels? I think, yes. Other languages for distributed programming lean more towards calling a function on another machine. Right? So calling a function on another machine, waiting for it to compute its answer, and then send a message back, at least transparently. So this is Java RMI, Corba, Orca, and Rendezvous is Ada. We'll look at those alternatives in a minute. So Ada has a rendezvous for remote procedure call. What does it mean to have rendezvous? A rendezvous between two parties is where both parties come together. Right? With a remote procedure call, it's more single-sided. I do something, send a message to the other side, I'll invoke something, and I'll return back. The other side does not have to accept what I send it. With rendezvous, it's the other way around. I send a message to the other side, and the other side should explicitly accept my message. Right? This remote procedure call. So whenever a remote procedure calls need to be explicitly accepted, that is rendezvous. Explicitly accept remote procedure calls. Okay. In Ada, that is via these accept statements. So an accept statement says that somebody else can now send me a remote procedure call, and with this accept statement, I accept this remote procedure call and allow its execution, allow it to be executed. Right? So many languages that support rendezvous allow some way of delaying unwanted method calls. So everybody is sending me messages, but I only want to deal with remote procedure calls of a given type. All the other remote procedure calls that everybody else is sending me, I want to ignore for a bit. Right? And only when I have time and resources, only then do I service these other kinds of remote procedure calls. So this is called pending entry calls, if I block or at least don't listen to a given type of remote procedure call. This is how it looks like in Ada. In Ada, I need to execute a select statement. So when some condition holds, so some resource is free, only then do I allow this type of remote procedure call. So when buffer is not full, then I accept put something in buffer as a remote procedure call. And then some code for doing the actual stuff, right? For actually putting something into a buffer. So these when statements are called guards, right? You have a number of guards, or when condition, when condition, when condition. Those are guards. And these are atomically surfaced, right? So only one of these when conditions will be invoked at one time, right? So if five remote procedure calls are sent to the same server, the server will accept only one of them, with the others pending. And don't I have to execute the select statement again to process the next remote procedure call. And I do it again and again and again, this thing in a loop, until there are no more things to be serviced. So this is how it looks like for our buffer example, right? When number of lines some bigger than zero, then I can accept a get command. If the buffer is currently empty, then I cannot accept the get message, right, until somebody else sends me a put message, right? So somebody else does number of lines plus plus. Only when that happens, can this number of lines be reevaluated and re-executed. So internally in an ADA system, it will continually look at all of these conditions and see and determine it looks at all the conditions in the loop, and if one of these conditions returns true, then it will jump to one of these accept statements. These select statements are called from tasks. So a task is an independent entity, a process. So a task is some sort of process that runs in parallel. And in a task, you can then loop while program is not finished, and then accept remote procedure calls from clients. So this is the server, and the client sends me these remote procedure calls. So when number of lines smaller than max, then the buffer is not full yet, and I can put my line of text into the buffer. Right, and then number of lines is incremented. So when this thing is re-executed, number of lines is bigger than zero, and then the get remote procedure call can be accepted again. So rendezvous is really both the sender and the receiver have to come to get a little, make one step towards each other before this thing works. Right? So how to use the buffer? There's some surrounding code. First, you have to allocate it, start it locally. So you locally start the server, and the client then goes towards the server via an access to this task object. Right? All of these select statements run are sequentially evaluated, but atomically. So first it'll have priority for the first case. Only if the first case doesn't apply, it'll go to the second case, and then go to the third, and so forth. So not all of these executions are of the same priority. There's also a after 10 seconds, because there's distributed programming, there can be a network error. The network cable can be broken, and no more messages can arrive. And then we should be able to detect that some network failure has occurred that you do via the timeouts. So I can detect timeouts in distributed programming. So this leads us towards lightweight objects. So a lightweight object is a task plus some control flow. This is a passive object, so you first need to create a normal task, which can use these protected objects for encapsulating these select statements. Right. So here's an integer object which has an entry call for awaiting zero, so somebody can send the int object a await zero remote procedure call, and this int object can then await, can accept this remote procedure call via this await zero. So this is a sort of mini rendezvous, these entry calls for protected objects. So I talked a whole lot about remote procedure call as a way of explaining rendezvous, right? Rendezvous is accepting remote procedure calls. So what are the options for remote procedure call? Well, first we need to have to wait for a for the answer of a remote procedure call. It's not always needed. So there's a controversy in when you're designing a remote procedure call if void return values are really needed, right? For example,
void foo,
and you call this a process. Process void and then some code. If I invoke foo, do an x plus plus after, right? Should I wait for foo to finish? Why, right? It returns void. If it returns void, there's no answer that it can deliver. So I can do this x plus plus in parallel to executing foo. Right? This is a design question, right? So remote procedure call we should look like as much as possible as a local function call. So there's no distinction between local function calls and remote procedure calls. That is the ideal. It doesn't work, right? Because, for example, the calling convention by remote procedure calls is different from a local procedure call. Like arguments are copied over the network to the other side and then unpacked and then sent and not sent back for any changes. So if you have call by value instead of call by reference, how do we get around making remote procedure calls use call by reference? It's tricky. What you can do, for example, is copy back semantics. For example, in copy back semantics, if you have this remote procedure call foo, let's give this foo an argument. Int array a. Right? And then in the code of foo, I do a index 0 is 3. Right, and then end of code. What I want to do, if I want to make a remote procedure call look like a local procedure call, if after this foo, I then do print a of 0, right? If I have call by value semantics without copy back, then this assignment is made at the receiver, and this change is not propagated back towards the sender. So this will print the old value of A0, not the new value of A0. If it copy back, I copy the arguments back towards the sender and then overwrite the old values. So after foo is executed, the arguments are copied back. So this will print 3, right? So with copy back semantics, it will print the correct thing, what you would expect. Another way to do it is avoiding the differences between argument passing types. So if A is read only, it will always, this by definition, it will always print the old value, right? Because it can't change the argument of a remote procedure call. So avoiding you can patch it or avoid the problem. Right. So there's a whole bunch of machinery in the background to allow remote procedure call to be implemented. For marshalling and unmarshalling is taking the arguments and converting the arguments to a byte array the byte array we can send over the network. That's what we need. But we need some sort of protocol for packing the arguments to the byte array. Right? So there's a service for accepting the RPCs, and you need to have some sort of concurrency control at the server so that not too many of the remote procedure calls are active at the same time, at least when you're accessing the same data. So whenever you have some innocent looking statement like line is buffer get, internally there's a lot going on in the runtime system. That stuff is unpacked, packed back into buffers, into byte arrays, and so forth. There are locks and unlocks being executed. So lots of overhead for an innocent looking statement. So there's a concept in programming languages called what you see is how cheap it should be. Right? If you see something innocent, it should be fast. If you see something complex, you can expect it to be slow. It should not be that you look at some construct in a language and it looks innocent while it is actually very slow. Right? So we need some sort of expectation of performance, and that is lost with remote procedure call. Let's look at Erlang. Erlang is an example language with intended for distributed processing. So there's a number of, you have individual processes that communicate via channels like Occam. It's functional, right? So you have list matching, pattern matching, querying, whatever you expect from a functional language. So there's two pieces of Erlang code. You have a module, export the faculty function, and faculty is when some condition then recurs, otherwise it's one. Right? So it's pattern matching as we've seen it before with all the other functional languages as well. Those data structures, yes, tuples. The tuple is effectively a list with a fixed size. There's lists with a head and a tail, as we've seen by all the other functional languages as well. There's atoms. An atom is a binding for a variable name or symbolic name with a value. So here's a string output formatted via, so this is slash n in Java or in C, instead of with a tilde. So it's formatted IO, pattern matching. You can look at this code later on your own. So head and tail for lists. You can nest lists in other lists. So other functional languages have list flattening. Whenever you add a list to a list as a sub-element, the list is flattened toward a single list. Erlang allows lists, sublists. Right? There's pattern matching as well, so you can extract E1, E2, and E3 from a sublist, and you get a sublist. So it's functional. Right? Here's a form of MapReduce. So I have a bit of code. Define doubler as a function. It multiplies the argument by 2. Create a list of integers, and then form a mapper which applies the doubler function to the list. It doubles every element in a list and creating a new list. So it's sort of MapReduce. So say something here, we are doing something parallel. So spawn spawns a new process that starts executing the say something function with hello and 3 as arguments, and it spawns another function would say something. So these two things are running in parallel. So parallel execution is just like fork, and join. It's not that different. Right. For message passing models towards whatever Occam did. So we have a process ID, and I sent this process, the result of evaluating this term, an exclamation mark, just like Occam for saying, I want to send. For a receive, there's pattern matching. So I receive some values, and then I perform pattern matching to see what kind of message has arrived. So pattern matching on received message types. Here's an example. So ping pong between two processes. So I have a ping and a pong. Ping, ping, pong. First, where do I start here? I start. I create a pong pit. So the result of spawn is a pit. And I spawn the ponger. The ponger does not know the pinger yet. So then I spawn the ponger and pass it the pinger, the pong idea. So the ponger knows the pong pit. Right. Did I do something wrong? Yes. No, I did it right. Instead of ponger, the ponger flips between two pongers. That's it. So I have two pongers. So I have two pongers, and I pong a ping pong a message between the two pongers. Right, so I start with a ponger, spawn two pongers. The ponger pattern matches and sees and either the received message or it receives the ping and the ping pit. Then I start the code, so start something. Invoke pong recursively to receive the next message, and here I send to the ping pong, the ping pit, the pong message, and it flips back between ping and pong. That works. So the exclamation mark was like Occam, right? It's a send message, and the receive statement is for receiving a message via pattern matching. Pattern matching for functional languages is used for seeing what kind of message arrives. So enhance robustness, because like ADA, messages or message channels can have a timeout. So if a network cable is broken, you can time out on a network cable without hanging the entire program. You are, however, not forced to write a timeout. So if you forget a timeout somewhere in your code, the whole thing will hang forever. There's research to be done here. How do you force that the program has enough timeout commands so it will never hang and will never deadlock? Deadlock detection in Erlang is also not there yet, so there's enough to be done. And I'll see you next week.